Good morning. We had a great weekend this weekend. We had our first, hopefully, annual family scavenger hunt. And if you were there, you know how much fun we had. And if you weren't there, but you were around town and you saw a bunch of Nazarenes running around like crazies, that was us. We had a bunch of fun and looking forward to doing it next year. In November, it is a very special time. In November, we will all gather together. You might come over to the D-Zone. You'll go to your own places. And together as a country, we will cast our vote for the presidential candidate that we think will do the best job in running our country. And with this election and with any kind of election comes a lot of promises that are made during this time. If you think about maybe state elections or county elections, even school government elections, there's a lot of promises that are made during this time. And I remember when I was in elementary school, Baby Bush, the son Bush, and Al Gore were going toe-to-toe in the presidential election. And during that time, we got these little newsletters, these papers that the school gave us, and it would update us on the election. It kept us, as much as you can keep a kid aware of things like that, it kept us aware of things that were going on in the election and would let us know who had this state and who had that state. And I remember there was this one section that talked about all the promises that George W. made and all of the promises that Al Gore made when that they made that said, if we're going to become president, this will happen. But it also listed some like historical presidential promises from candidates. And some of them were kind of funny. And I remembered some of them. And then I did some research and found some. In 1976, Jimmy Carter ran for president, and he promised the United States, he promised, "I will never lie to you if I become president." That's a great vote of confidence. Warren Harding, when he ran for president, he promised the nation that it was time to go back to the good old days, and he said, "If I become president, I will make things return to normal." No change. Nothing awesome, no, you know, great big thing happening. No, just normal. Teddy Roosevelt, when he ran the second time, he promised, he said, "If you elect me, I will never run again." And he did not keep that promise. He ran for a third time. Herbert Hoover, when he ran for president, he promised a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. And personally, you know, there was a prosperity promise, but personally, I have images of a Tyson truck coming to every single house in America and bringing a chicken in a pot. And just recently, Barack Obama, when he ran this last time, he promised that if he became president, he would stop calling Mitt Romney weird. I don't know if he's kept that promise, but that was one of his promises. Whatever political affiliation you're in, or whatever you belong to, or whatever you believe, when it comes to promises made by political candidates, we all kind of tend to roll our eyes a little bit. Because it seems to me like we have this hierarchy of promises, this level to promises. There's different types of promises, and they're on different levels. At the very bottom, we have political promises, promises that are made during election time, promises that are just heard, not just presidential. I mean, if you think about school government promises that you might have made or you might have heard, you know, ice cream every day or maybe a pool in the school. But when we hear those kind of promises, election promises, they're on the bottom. We don't really listen. They don't really come true. We don't really know if they're broken. And then right above that, we have verbal promises, like promises of, "Yes, dear, I will help you do this." Or, "Yes, dear, we will do this." Promises that we make that we just make off the cuff, and most wives know those don't come true. So they're a little bit above the politicians, but you've got your verbal promises right there. And then right above that, you have promises that are written down. Promises that are written down in stone. Think like contracts, deeds to land, deeds to houses, marriage certificates. Promises that we make, but we can break. We can get out of them. We shouldn't, but we can get out of them. And it takes a little longer to do that, and you have to go through all the government. But then, at the very, very top, you have promises that you make to your child. Because you know, if you make a promise to a child, you have to keep it. It is unbreakable. You make a promise to a child, and if you don't keep that promise, they're going to remind you of that promise. Especially if there was a pinky involved, then you know you've got to keep it. If you promised your child one day when they were 3 years old and they're sitting in the back of the car and you promised them that you would go to Disney World when they're 11, guess what you're doing on their 11th birthday? You're going to Disney World. But there's a different kind of promise that in this hierarchy, in this level of promises, we're not really sure where does it fit in. We're not sure, is this kind of promise stronger than a promise made to a child? Or is this kind of promise go below a politician's promise? Because we don't really know where we believe and where we believe it should go. Where exactly do the promises of God fit in this scale that we have? And this is the question that Abraham and Sarah have had to grapple with their entire lives. Granted, they didn't have the blessing that we do. They didn't have the scriptures to tell them all of the stories of how God has kept his promises. They didn't have God's written down promises because they were at the very beginning, like 19 chapters in, and there they are. They didn't have all of those rich stories that we have. They didn't have all of the promises of God written down and passed from generation to generation. Abraham and Sarah just had to listen to God's promises. And they weren't really sure what kind of promise this was. God called Abraham out of a life of idolatry, out of a life that was really just fitting to where he lived. And he called Abraham and his family to be the beginning of a new group, to be the beginning of a new nation, to be the beginning of a new people, a nation that was not going to be marked or known by land or kings or stuff. This nation was going to be known because of their relationship with God. And God promised Abraham that he was going to be the father of many nations, that his family was going to be as numerous as the stars, as the grains of sand on the beach, that he was going to be the vessel of blessing to all of the world. But there's one tiny little problem. It's just Abraham and Sarah and a couple of servants. How can you have a big family when you don't have any kids? How can you have a big family when you don't even have a girl? Like, back then, boys were the big deal. They didn't even have a baby girl. How can you create a nation when it's just you and Sarah? And God promises to Abraham and Sarah and says, I will give you a child, a promised child. One day, you will be a father. One day, you will be a mother. And they hear this promise at the very beginning, this first promise, and they aren't too sure what kind of promise is this. This is a God that has called them out and has led them literally through deserts and through many different situations. And they're not really sure where does this promise fit. Especially when after they first hear that promise, a few months go by and there's no news. Every month passes by and Sarah has nothing to tell Abraham. And then months turn into years. And then years turn into decades. And there's nothing. No congratulations, no baby announcements, no gender reveal parties, nothing. Max Lucado, he describes this time for Sarah. He says she probably got excited when she first heard that promise. She visited a couple of the maternity shop tents, and she bought a few extra dresses with the elastic that's in the side that makes everything so comfortable. She plans her shower and remodels the tent, but there's still no child. She eats a few birthday cakes, and with each birthday cake, more and more candles get blown out, but there's still no child, not even a girl. She goes through a decade of wall calendars, and there's still no child. Finally, the wallpaper on the tent is starting to fall off, and it's faded, and the baby furniture is beginning to show some wear and tear from being inside of a tent. And just the mere topic, just the mere idea of a promised child brings sighs brings tears, brings a lot of disbelief. Sarah gets to a point where she doesn't believe in God's promises anymore. To her, it's lower than a politician's promise. So Sarah takes God's promise into her own hands. She thinks she can force the timing of God. She thinks if Abraham is going to be this father of many nations, then let's get the ball rolling because it's not happening with me. And a whole big situation happens and you can read all about it. And the end result is no good. Another woman is brought into this situation, and we all know that's not good. And from that situation comes another child, and that's not good. And the whole situation turns ugly. And during this time, after Sarah forces God's promise to come true, time passes by, except this time it's different. Before this ugly and horrible and nasty situation happens, God is constantly talking with Abraham, constantly reminding Abraham of his promise, constantly reminding Abraham that he will be faithful. But now, God is silent. 13 years have passed, and in those 13 years, there is silence. No reminder. No, hey, I am still faithful. No, hey, you're still waiting on a kid. Just silence. Abraham and Sarah are now older and grayer. And if you could go lower than a politician's promise, there is about as low as you can go when it comes to believing in God's promises. And this is where we pick up with them in chapter 18. If you would turn there in your Bibles and stand as we read the word today. In chapter 18, starting with verse 1, it reads, "The Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre, while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, 'If I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under the tree. Let me get you something to eat, so you can be refreshed and then go on your way, now that you have come to your servant.' 'Very well,' they answered. 'Do as you say.' So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah. 'Quick,' he said, 'get 3 seahs of the finest flour and knead it and bake some bread.' Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice, tender calf and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. He then brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While they ate, he stood near them under a tree. 'Where is your wife, Sarah?' they asked him. 'There, in the tent,' he said. Then one of them said, 'I will surely return to you about this time next year. And Sarah, your wife, will have a son.' Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, 'After I am worn out, and my Lord is old, will I now have this pleasure?' Then the Lord said to Abraham, 'Why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son.' Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, 'I didn't laugh.' But he said, 'Yes, you did laugh. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.'" You can be seated. Right the chapter before this passage, right before chapter 18 and chapter 7, God finally breaks that 13 year of silence. He finally breaks that silence and reminds Abraham that even though Abraham wasn't faithful, God is still going to be faithful. And Abraham, when he hears this, he's thinking, wait, you mean that promise about a kid? And when you read the story and you look at like the Hebrew, he really falls on the floor and starts rolling on the floor laughing because he cannot believe it because Sarah is old and he knows he's even older. And now after this, Abraham has 3 visitors that have come. And Abraham is sitting outside the tent where the breeze would come through. It's the hottest part of the day. I'm sure you all can remember yesterday, the hottest part of yesterday. And it's that hot, except a little bit drier. And Abraham was a good southerner. He was sitting on his front porch, and he would have had a tall glass of iced tea and a little fan, and he was probably sitting there dozing. But God appears to him and redirects his attention to the three people that are traveling, which is a weird sight. To us, that sounds like, okay, three people were traveling. That sounds like fun. But this is a weird sight. People did not travel in the heat of the day back then. They would find somewhere to rest and to let the hottest part pass by before they would get up to travel. They would travel in the morning and then take a break in the afternoon and then travel in the evening. You know, the greatest, coolest times. And Abraham, he's a traveler. He's a nomad. He knows this. He knows the times that you're supposed to travel. His family lives in tents. They travel with their grazing herds. And there's a community amongst travelers. There's a community against nomads that live in the desert. They depend on each other. They depend on each other for survival. They depend on each other for companionship. They depend on each other for help. So Abraham is looking at these travelers traveling in the heat of the day and probably thinking, bless their heart. And he goes up and he runs to them. And the fact that he's running is amazing on four counts. The first one is it's hot and he is running. The second one is he is old and he is running. The third one is that in chapter 17, he and his entire family have surgery. All of the males in his house have a major surgery that would make it very hard for them to run. I'll let you connect the dots on your own. So he's running after he just had surgery. Number four, it's hot. But Abraham knows that these aren't just normal visitors that are traveling in the heat of the day. Something is up. So Abraham runs to them and invites them over for some water and bread, just water and bread. And instead of what he has told them, he brings them the best kind of bread, the bread that King Solomon eats later on in the Bible. This is the bread that the king selects. This is the bread that is the best of the bread. And he brings them milk and he brings them curds and he brings them veal, basically. Again, Abraham is a good southerner and is bringing out that good southern hospitality. And these visitors are having a great time together. Abraham is not sitting with them like he should have been. He is standing up so that if they need anything, he can go and get it at a moment's notice, which lets us know that these aren't just your normal visitors. Something's up with these visitors. A lot of commentators and a lot of people who are smarter than me go back and forth on who are these visitors. Some say they were angels that were walking around and that came to Abraham. Some say maybe this was King Melchizedek who comes and visits Abraham and it's him and it's his posse that travels around with him. Some people say that this is the Trinity. This is the Father, this is the Son, this is the Holy Ghost who are in human bodies and are visiting with Abraham. Whoever these visitors are, somehow they know that Abraham is married to a girl named Sarah. And they ask him, where is Sarah? Sarah is off in her tent. It was common and it was a custom for women when men came to visit, women would go into the tent and hide, basically. It was probably smart for safety reasons, you know, make sure your women are protected. But it was also the whole women shouldn't be seen or heard or whatever. But she's there inside the tent, and we know a lot about Sarah. Sarah is not one of those passive women who is just going to sit and be content. She's probably sitting out towards the flap, crocheting, you know, where the breeze can touch her face, but also where the breeze can bring the voices in so she can hear what's going on between the visitors and Abraham. And as she's sitting there, she's hearing the visitors saying, where is she? She's in the tent. Oh, well, by next time this year, she will have a son. This time, the promise doesn't come in a one day. This doesn't come in the future. Today, the promise comes in, hey, in 3 months, your wife is going to get pregnant. And by the spring, you are going to have a son. This is a today it's happening kind of promise. And when Sarah hears this, she laughs. She laughs because she's old. The time for promises, the time for a promise like this, is long gone. And the question comes up, is anything too hard for God? Is any promise too big for God to keep? Is there a time limit on when God is supposed to make his promises come true? The Lord has promised Abraham and Sarah to do something extraordinary in their lives. If God had done it earlier on in their lives, when they were in that correct age range, then it wouldn't have been something extraordinary. It would have been something ordinary. But now that they're old, it's going to be extraordinary. And God is inviting Sarah and Abraham to trust him with something so absurd it makes Sarah laugh. And then Sarah lies. She doesn't have a good track record. But at this point, I'm not so sure if Sarah is laughing because she doesn't believe in God. I'm not sure if she's laughing because she doesn't think that it's a miracle God can't do. I think Sarah is laughing because she doubts that God could do it for her, that God could do it through her. Because the reality of who she is, the reality of all of the mistakes she's made, all of the times that she's forced God's promises, that reality, and the reality of what stage of life she's in, makes her doubt that God would actually choose her, that God would actually choose her to be a vessel of a promise. This was more than just a promise of having a child and all the wonderful joys that come with that. This was a promise that God was going to start being active in the world, in their life, that God was going to work through a couple of broken human beings to give them their promise so that the rest of us could enjoy the promise of his son. I think too often we're like Sarah. We have all of these promises in the Bible and we can read them and we can believe in them, but we really doubt, can God do that for me? Can God's promises be used through me? There's an actual word for it. It's called functional deism. It means that we believe in God. It means that we believe in the stories. We believe in the word. We believe that God actually exists. We're not atheists. We're not agnostic. We believe in God. But we never expect or believe that God would get involved in human affairs, that God would intercede in our lives, that God would guide us, that God would care for a loved one. We believe in God, but we have a hard time believing that God is actually going to heal the hurts that we suffer, that God is going to do something impossible through us and in our lives. Yes, God has done miracles in the Bible. He has kept promises to us as a whole. He's done great and mighty things, but when it comes to God doing great things through us, we tend to limit God a little bit. We laugh a little, like Sarah did. We believe that God can do something, but we doubt that he can do it for us and in our lives. We believe that God can forgive. But as we look back over our past, if we look what we're doing in our present, sometimes we doubt that he can forgive us. We believe that God can meet the needs of his people. He's done it time and time and time again. But when we look at the needs that we have today, we doubt, can he really take care of those? We believe that God pours out his spirit on his people and he gives them power and he gives them courage. But when we look at the situations that we're in, the words that we need to say, we doubt that God could give us power, that God could give us courage. We believe that God can give freedom from addictions and things that hold us down. But when we look at our addictions, when we look at the things that hold us down, we think, can God really do that for me? You believe that Christ gives, and he promised to us that we would have abundant life. But we doubt that we can actually live that abundant life. This isn't a prosperity gospel type of message. This isn't a if you believe it, it will come message. It's a message that reminds us that God is not limited by our limitations. You might be 90 years old, but God can still use you for his glory. There are tons of stories in the Bible. There are tons of stories in church history. There are tons of stories today where God chooses people who we would say are limited, who we would say have no business doing what he's called them to do. David was too young to be a king, but God used him to kill a giant and to bring a new era for the people of God. Esther was too young to be a queen, and she shouldn't have been where she was. But God used her to be the savior of the Jewish nation. Moses couldn't speak really well, and he was a murderer. But God used him to lead millions of people out of bondage. Paul was the number one enemy of the church. But God used him to bring the good news to the Gentiles. God can do anything, even if that anything is through you. I know there have been times in my life where God has reminded me, where God has called me, and I have sat there thinking, yeah, you can do that, but I can't. Yeah, you choose somebody else. I'm limited. I can't do that. I remember thinking when I was getting ordained, I was sitting there and there was a sea of black and blue suits all around me. And I was sitting there at the altar and Dr. Jess was getting ready to come to me. And I was just sitting there thinking, this is a great holy moment. I'm so proud. But there's no way God is going to be able to do anything through me or use me in any way. I'm limited. And Sarah in this passage is looking at God and saying, God, your promise? There's no way you can do it. Not through me. Not by using me. But do you know what happened a year later in Sarah's life? A 91-year-old woman welcomed a healthy baby boy into the world. And she laughed. This time, it was a different kind of laugh. This time, it was the laughter of joy that God would use her. It was the laugh that God did something impossible through her. It was the laugh that despite her limitations, despite her past, despite all of the decisions that she's made, despite all of the doubts that she had, God still kept his promise. We serve a God who loves to show off, who loves to knock our socks off and do the impossible. He's made the sun stand still for an entire day. He's made dead bones come to life. He has sent a baby to the world so that we could have life. We serve a God who not only delights in doing impossible things, but calling impossible people to do them. He's called murderers. He's called adulterers. He's called teenagers and children. He's called idol worshipers and fishermen. He's called babies. He's called women so that his promises can come true. The promises of God are not dead. They are not lower than a politician's promise. They are so much higher than the promise to a child. And they have no time limit. They are still alive and they are still well. And God is looking at us and he's inviting us to become a part of those promises. He can keep his promises despite us. He can choose to make all of his promises come true in the Bible and in our lives without us. But our God is not a God who does something by himself. He invites us to become a part of him, to work, to use us, to work through us. He does not forget his promises. He does not believe in Crossy's count. He does not renege on his promises. God will keep his promises. The only question that's left is, how are we going to respond? What kind of laugh are we going to have? Are we going to laugh with doubt and unbelief that God has the ability to work in us and through us? When we hear God's promises to us, are we going to laugh and say, yeah, you can do that, but not through me. There's no way. Or are we going to laugh with joy that despite our limitations, despite the realities of our world and our situations, despite our past and the life that we're living now, that we get to be a part of God's promises. Would you stand and pray with me today?